So it's my pleasure again to introduce Ron Young. We had a wonderful discussion on Monday, and I found out two things since Monday about Ron.
Uh-oh.
First, he has a great sense of humor, right, which I totally appreciate. Secondly, his grandson is almost as cute as mine, but he has longer eyelashes.
I heard you talking about his eyelashes.
They're like this long. Absolutely adorable and a delight to have in the village. So thank you, Ron.
Well, I think you met both of us at the right moments. just first a word, at the end of last session, I mentioned that there's been a series of articles recently about regretting the diminution of Pax Americana, with the view that when there is a pursuit of Pax Americana, the world is more stable, if not more just or peaceful, but at least more stable. And these authors are worried that each in his own way, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, George W. Bush by invading Iraq, Barack Obama by his idea of leading from the back, and Trump by being a narcissistic, disturbed personality, all are risking that Pax Americana will not exist anymore. My own view, as you might guess, is that Pax Americana was never a terrific idea. And I've got two things up here which you can pick up. One is from a lecture I gave last April at Kendall, a Quaker Living Center in Philadelphia, on how the Iran nuclear deal opened up possibilities of new things happening in the world and the U.S. playing a role in that, which were not Pax Americana. It was not the U.S. in charge, but the U.S. being helpful to move things in a new direction. So that lecture is here, and there are 25 copies. Take them, share them. And then I outrageously suggested that I was pleased when candidate Trump said, wouldn't it be good if the U.S. and Russia cooperated? And I said, yeah, it would. That would be a good idea. And I didn't like myself saying it because every other thing he said, I reacted negatively to, or almost everything. But there's an article up here that I wrote just in the last week suggesting how that might be interesting, and the fact that Henry Kissinger, who's no favorite of mine, but who is smart and gave up his old anti-Russian biases when the Soviet Union ended, has written about Russia and U.S. cooperating in Ukraine. And interestingly enough, Kissinger was in Moscow last week to meet with Putin, and Putin and Trump will meet this week on the edges of the G20 meeting in Europe. So is something going on? Well, I'm both hopeful enough and, you know, if you want to say humble enough, that is, we don't know everything and we're not right about everything, that maybe Trump and Putin would actually do something that could be helpful. So there's an article up there. If you can stomach reading anything that says Trump could do something helpful, take a look at it. So these two articles are here. You can pick them up at the end. So where we start today is with a troubling disagreement. I mean, isn't it easier when the saints we admire all agree, you know? A lot of times they do, and we're comforted because we agree with them, and what else is there to know, you know? But here's a case where Gandhi, I assume one of our heroes, and Martin Luther King, I assume another of our heroes, disagreed. One, Gandhi, writing in 1948 in one of his regular magazines, writes about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, "My sympathies are all with the Jews, but my sympathy does not blind me to the requirements of justice. The cry for the national home for the Jews does not make much appeal to me. Palestine belongs to the Arabs." Pretty clear. And then Martin Luther King, in a letter he wrote to an anti-Zionist, and you know the word Zionism basically means Jewish nationalism. That's what it means. He's writing to a friend who's an anti-Zionist, in other words, probably Jewish, or perhaps Jewish, maybe Christian, who's against the idea of Jewish nationalism, against the idea of a Jewish state or Israel as a Jewish state. So King writes, "And what is anti-Zionist? It is the denial to the Jewish people of a fundamental right. It is anti-Semitism." Well, so here we have these two giants of spiritual and political leadership and inspiration disagreeing. Now, obviously, they're writing at different times. And by the way, one of the wonderful things you might want to look into is there's a long correspondence between Gandhi and Martin Buber. Buber, you know, was involved at the creation of Israel and critical of certain things about the creation of Israel, but nevertheless supportive of the creation of Israel. And Buber and Gandhi have an exchange of letters that you can find, again, the famous Google. So Gandhi's writing in 48, and King is writing in 68, so 20 years later. Some questions that I think are helpful to think about, and I'm happy to spend some minutes this morning getting some thoughts about it. What in Gandhi's and in King's deepest principled beliefs might have led them to hold these views? What in Gandhi's and King's religious traditions might have influenced their views? And just think, for instance, of the fact that King, as a Christian, Baptist Christian minister, inherited the whole Hebrew scripture and the prophets, right? So obviously he's got a link to Jewish scriptures that Gandhi doesn't have, even though he may know about them. Certainly Hinduism does not come out of the same text where King does, but that's just an example. And then I ask, what in the context of the time and place in which each man espoused these views might have influenced them? Different time, different place.
Ron?
Yes.
When you first talked about Gandhi's, you said 1948.
I'm written here 38. You know what? I think that's a typo.
Okay.
That's interesting, and I'm not positive. I think it was 48, but now that puzzles me a little bit because I don't know. Somebody find out by tomorrow and come back and report. It's either 38 or 48, and I see what's on the paper that I typed, but I know that I've typed things before that are screwed up. Yeah. It's interesting.
The time could make a difference.
Oh, yeah, the time makes a difference because in 38, obviously, Israel was not birthing or was not being birthed. It was an idea.
Thank you.
Well, hadn't happened, was beginning to happen, right? No, you're absolutely, there you go. I mean, that's exactly the kind of process I think you have to do to figure out why Gandhi said what he said then, and then you have to do the same thing with King. Yes?
King's father was very aware of what was happening in
He was indeed. He was indeed. I mean, in fact, they were there, right? I mean, there was a big worldwide Baptist convention. In fact, it's where Father King decided he wanted to take the name Martin Luther and then gave his son that name because his son's names were Michael, as I recall. So we could be talking about Michael Luther Jr., but we're talking about, Michael King Jr., we're talking about Martin Luther Jr. Martin Luther King Jr. Okay, so anybody else want to either offer an idea or how you go about figuring out why these two heroes of ours have different views?
I'm willing to go with my soul.
Yes, please.
I think it comes directly from their backgrounds.
Okay.
I think that King fought so hard for recognition of the black community.
Yes.
That a stronghold for Zionism was important to him. I think Gandhi had a more, I think he was up on the balcony more and saw a larger picture to include everyone.
Aha. Uh-huh. Interesting. Okay. Anybody else? Yes?
But Gandhi was trying to get rid of Britain.
Aha.
His agenda.
He was fighting the pressure, but I think he still, in his mind, I think he had a more encompassing.
It's interesting, more encompassing. What I hear from that corner is he was an embodiment of anti-colonialism at the time. Right. And in a certain sense, the creation of Israel looked like a repetition of colonialism. And to many people, I mean, certainly to the Palestinians it did. Certainly, to pass. So there's that too. Yes, others. Yeah.
I kind of would echo that. I think Gandhi, for him, anti-colonialism was so important. It may have blinded him to some things because I've read some of his earlier writings where he said thinks Hitler is a great guy, a great leader,
Oh, really? That's,
to me,
wow.
That's fascinating. I mean, because he viewed Hitler again as someone who was going to upset that colonial.
Oh my goodness gracious! That's I've never heard. How many people have heard that he admired Hitler?
Earlier, right now,
wow.
I may have changed his mind.
No. I understand, but still, no. It's obviously it's something to take note of.
It's interesting to me, and I still respect him a lot. I think
well, of course.
In the 30s, probably before World War II, so he may have not realized how bad Hitler was.
Yeah.
But I think he really, he really wanted that imperial, that sort of imperial colonial status quo. I
just heard. I'll tell this as briefly as I can, but I heard a story just in the last hour of Trevor Noah. You know that name?
Yeah.
Okay. Tells a story about when he was growing up, a teenager, and he was into DJing and music and so forth. And there were friends of his, blacks. He was white black. Black friends of his who were great dancers. And they were often, as kids, when they were babies, they were named sort of just out of whatever people heard names. So the best dancer with his troupe was named Hitler. And they did a DJ party for in a white suburb that happened to be a Jewish family celebrating. And so the dancers come out, and then at a certain point says, "And that best dancer is Hitler! Go, Hitler! Dance! Dance, Hitler, dance!" And the Jews just fell out, pulled the plug on the DJ, the party was over. But it was all, you know, no. I mean, the blacks and Trevor Noah didn't know what was going on. They didn't know Hitler from Schmidtler. It was just this kid's name, and he was a great dancer. Who else wants to comment on this? What about King? What about King? What's his business with Zionism? Why did he? Yeah.
The Baptist tradition has a strong connection to the establishment and growth of Jerusalem as a Jewish state. Like, that is one of the deep parts of their theology.
And that's scripturally based. Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And don't you think it might have something to do also with the Jewish support for the Civil Rights Movement?
Very much so.
Strong support, among the strongest of any minority in our country. Jews were supportive, and there was a close relationship. So that produced both understanding and also ties and commitments to each other. So it's interesting. I mean, we're dealing, you know, when we say saints, we're not dealing with non-human beings. We're not dealing with people who don't operate and live in contexts of their period and time and place. So I think it's worth thinking about, and part of the reason I put it first is that if there's anything that bothers me more about the discussion of the Middle East, there's nothing that bothers me more than absolute certainty that one side has the truth about it. And part of that comes from, I mean, two experiences I've had. One, working for the Quakers, living in the Middle East, traveling Israel, West Bank, Gaza, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and listening to people. And really listening to their stories. And when you listen to people's stories, they're convincing. Even though they may be contradictory, they're convincing. So that's part of the experience, the background. And then the second part of it is when I began doing work for peace in the Middle East after we returned in 85, I decided that the way I wanted to try to do that, partly because of experience I had had in the Civil Rights Movement, was working on an interfaith basis. And of course, once I thought of that, I thought of the challenge. It was easy for me to think of Jews and Christians working together, but then I think, oh, Muslims, what about Muslims? And I had to begin to discover American Muslims, whom I didn't know. I knew Muslims in Jordan, I knew Muslims in Palestine, I knew Muslims in Syria and Egypt, etc. But I didn't know any Muslims, so I began to ask my Christian and Jewish friends, do you happen to know Muslims? And several did, and that one thing led to another, and soon we had a group. By 87, we had a group that was willing to meet in Washington that included Jewish, Christian, and Muslim American leaders, when I say leaders, from mainstream parts of their communities. You know, you can always find somebody on the fringe of one community who will agree with the mainstream of the other community. But what I thought was important to try to do was to find people from the mainstream of Jewish life in America, Muslim life, Christian life, that would come together. And by the way, the Lutheran Church played a very important part in that, the formation of that committee. 50 people, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, met in Washington, D.C., totally off the record, and formed something called the U.S. Interreligious Committee. And it was a, you know, in one sense, it was a simple idea. On the other hand, for many of them, it was a rather daring prospect because they had real connections to the conflict, many of them deeply on one side or the other. I remember at one point as we were developing the initial statement, someone said, well, what about Jerusalem? Don't we need to address Jerusalem? It was a Muslim. And a rabbi from Chicago, who was known to be outspoken and courageous, said, oh my God, you've killed the project now. And then we sent a half dozen people out of the room to try to work on something to say about Jerusalem. And we did. We agreed on something to say about Jerusalem. That happened in 1987. And my work over the years with people from the mainstream of the Jewish community, Christian community, and Muslim community, including, by the way, evangelicals. One of the people I work very closely with is Leighton Ford, who's married to Billy Graham's sister. And if you know Billy Graham, something about Billy Graham, his son Franklin didn't follow his way. No, and that's important to remember because sometimes we lump the evangelicals in one lump. And just like Lutherans, there are more than one lump. There are several different lumps and bumps. All right, so, you know, we're not going to resolve this King Gandhi thing, but I think it's an interesting and a little bit provocative in the sense of, no, wait, did you know Gandhi and King had very different views? Well, okay, that's interesting. Let's look at that. What I want to do today, and it's a presumptuous task, but why not be that way, as long as you're also open to the idea that you're not, everything you say is not like the final word or something. I want to deal with two topics. First, why did 6 U.S. initiatives for peace between Israel and the Palestinians fail? You know? I mean, it's interesting that the commitment by the United States in foreign policy to try to resolve the Israeli or Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been longstanding. I mean, basically since the 40s, 50s, and actively at least since the late 60s and 70s, and then into the 70s, why did 6 peace initiatives fail? Well, the first thing to say is there's plenty of blame to go around. But I'm going to focus on what problems there were with the U.S. way of doing it that contributed to the failures of those initiatives. And second, I want to look at the question of 2 states. Is that still the idea? You know, President Trump said, well, I'm in support of 1 state, 2 state, whatever they can agree on, which seems on the surface to be a reasonable proposition. And I want to look at that and see where we are about what might happen. So, starting back in 1973, by the way, in 1973, war, Arab-Israeli war, was the 4th Arab-Israeli war. First was 48, then was 56 over the Suez Canal and nationalization of the Suez Canal, then was 67, which created, in some sense, created both the territorial framework and the international legal framework for resolving the conflict, UN Resolution 242. So that was the 3rd Arab-Israeli war, and 1973 was the 4th. Both the particularly the 67 and 73 wars, the Arabs started out in the war with a great sense we're going to be victorious. And the Israelis were nervous, possibly we might be done away with. That is, the state of Israel would be destroyed. And during that period, and really from 1948 to 1988, and this, just to take account of this, almost takes one's breath away, both sides wanted the other side to disappear. Both sides wanted the other side to disappear. And what I mean by that is the Arabs wanted Israel to disappear. The Arabs never were committed to the idea of disappearing the Jews. In that sense, they were not Nazis. They were not Nazis. And anybody who makes that case is making it for the purpose of argument. But it's false. The Arabs never had the idea of getting rid of the Jews, but they did have the idea of not accepting Israel and getting rid of Israel as a state. On the Israeli side, and they encapsulated that beginning in 67 in what were called the three no's. And they were, you know, not much to build a peace agreement on. No to negotiation with Israel. No to recognition with Israel. And no to Israel as a state. No to peace with Israel as a state. Whoop, there goes that side of the negotiation. Well, the Israelis had their three no's. Because the Palestinians, represented in the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, expressed their absolutely firm, determined, and rooted claim to the same land that was Israel. And the Israeli no's went like this. No to negotiations with the PLO. No to recognition of a Palestinian state. So they had their, I said two, but there was, I lost the third one. It's in there somewhere, and it's consistent with the other two. Don't worry, or don't be hopeful. I mean, it's three no's that are pretty solid. I mean, if you won't talk with the Palestinian representative, what the hell, where's peace going to come from? So the Israelis were always interested in the possibility of peace with the Arab states, but not with the Palestinians, because the Palestinians claimed the very same land that Israel was claiming and was on and had been founded on in 48. So after the fourth Israeli-Arab War, 1973, President Sadat in Egypt begins to recognize that Israel is not going away. And by the way, that reality was basic to the possibility of peace in both directions. That is, as Arab states and Palestinians recognized that Israel wasn't going away. And they recognized because after each war, Israel was still there, and usually Israel had won the war. And on the other side, Israelis who wanted the Palestinians to go away were confronted with the fact that even despite the imbalance of power between Israel militarily and the Palestinians, Palestinians didn't go away. They kept protesting, they kept marching, they kept getting killed, their sons got killed. They kept coming because they believed in Palestine. So slowly, slowly, Israelis began to become convinced that Palestinians were not going away. So in 1977, President Sadat makes his historic offer to come to Jerusalem. And he does, and interestingly enough, I can't say all of this history, but pieces of it that at least have helped me to get a different grab of the thing. Jewish Egyptians, that is, Jews who had come to Israel from Egypt, lined the streets of Jerusalem and applauded Sadat's visit. Jews from Egypt. Why? Because all of a sudden they saw the prospect of their two homelands being living together, that they could imagine being feeling a sense of loyalty to Egypt where they had lived for many generations and a sense of loyalty to Israel. So all of a sudden, in a certain sense, their hearts were opened by Sadat in a way that European Jews would not necessarily have experienced. So Sadat comes and a process begins, and the U.S. in the person of Jimmy Carter, President Carter, gets involved. And I'll just say briefly, there's a marvelous several books about the Israeli-Egyptian process. It was exhausting. It was exhausting. Hal Saunders, who's a diplomat who was very much involved at Camp David in that process, tells Hal, the process was that the Egyptians and Israelis would talk during the day and the Americans would sit around on a sort of outer circle taking notes. They would then stay up all night to try to help decide what should be the focus the next day. So in a certain sense, they were round the clock. Where the Egyptians and the Israelis went back to their cabins and had some sleep time. So it was an exhausting process, but at the end of the process, with Carter sticking to it with a kind of Baptist determination, if you will, and if you read his books, you know that religion plays a role for Carter, with a kind of Baptist Christian determination, Egypt and Israel decide to make a peace agreement. Well, that busts open the Arab world, because now you have the largest Arab country agreeing to make peace with Egypt. And it didn't go down well with the other Arab countries. It didn't go down well. That is to say, in all the other Arab countries and the Palestinians denounced Egypt for making the peace agreement. And I can remember going to see the foreign minister of Egypt and saying, well, isn't this hard that all the Arab states and the Palestinians have denounced the agreement. This would have been in the early 80s. And he said to me, with all the sense of pharaonic pride and puffed upness, he said, oh, we don't worry about this. Eventually the Arabs will come around to understand that Egypt is the leader of the Arab world. And of course, there was an element of truth to it. Even puffed upness sometimes has some truth to it, because Egypt was very important. And by the way, other Arab states had also lost wars with Egypt, with Israel. So they were getting the message too, that Israel's probably here to stay. What are we going to do? We can't get rid of it. So you have a process then. Carter's successful. But where did the Palestinians come in? Well, the idea was that this was part of a process that would lead to peace between Israel and the Palestinians. The trouble was that there was such intensity devoted to getting the Egyptian-Israeli peace together that the Palestinian peace sort of slipped away, plus the fact that in the same year that the peace agreement between Egypt and Israel was signed, you had the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. So Jimmy Carter, who was devoted to this process, all of a sudden had something else to be devoted to or to be taken up with. And of course, it was a very rough period. The hostage crisis, as you remember, 444 days or something of Americans being held hostage from having been captured from the embassy. So the Palestinian issue doesn't make progress. And in a certain sense, Begin, the head of the Israeli government, was satisfied. He had to give back the Sinai, which was a big deal. And there were already some settlements in the Sinai, and he had to pull the settlements out. And there was oil in the Sinai, and he had to give up that. But he had the largest Arab country that was now at peace with Israel. And that meant, at a minimum, that the chances that the Arabs could make another or a successful war against Israel were greatly diminished. So it wasn't a bad bargain. That's the first initiative, Carter's. 1982, in the meantime, between then and 82, the Palestinians, who are largely based in Jordan, begin to feel their oats and express their political influence and power. And the king is not comfortable with that, to the extent where they begin to actually set up checkpoints on Jordanian highways and act as if they are a little state within a state. The Jordan king, no way. And so there's a war, or a battle anyway, between the Palestinians and Jordan. And the Palestinian movement, the PLO, flees to Lebanon. And Lebanon is a more loosely put together state than Jordan. So the PLO is able to find a base in Lebanon where they can operate with relative freedom and operating, included the idea that occasionally they would launch attack across the Lebanese-Israeli border. And of course the Israelis would put up with that for a little while, but not long, and then they would launch counterattacks. And in 1982, in June, the Israeli army, largely at the instigation of Sharon, in response to the PLO, invades Lebanon to destroy the PLO. So in they go, and of course the Lebanese, by the way, Shiite Lebanese, suffer the most because they live in the southern part of Lebanon, which is where the Israeli army went through. And initially, the Shiites there, the Lebanese, were rather sick and tired of the PLO, because they would get the counterpunch by Israel to the little punches that the Palestinians were able to throw at Israel, and they didn't like it. And now they've got a whole invasion on their hands and an occupation by Israel. That context, this is 1982, leads President Reagan to do his initiative for peace. Again, Reagan, even back then, was not a favorite president of mine. But as we, living in the region, looked at the initiative, it had certain potentials that looked positive. For example, it was one of the first times that the U.S. said that Palestinian rights and Israeli security had to be balanced in some way. He didn't say Palestinian national rights. He didn't say the right to a state. He wasn't willing to talk with the PLO. And by the way, by that time, most European countries were talking with the PLO. We were a bit slow coming to that. But at least he was saying Palestinian rights and Israeli security had to go, they had to somehow live with each other. So Reagan gets involved. Hopes are raised in the various countries. We were moving back, Carol and I were moving back and forth between the PLO and the Jordanian government and Egypt and the Israelis. And there was a rising of hope, including among Israelis. This is where the Israeli peace movement is formed. It's formed in 82 in the context of Israelis who were opposed to the invasion of Lebanon, but were also encouraged by the Reagan Initiative. And a group of reserve officers in the Israeli army formed Peace Now. One of our closest friends in Israel over the years is a man by the name of Mordechai Baron, who was actually the special executive assistant to Moshe Dayan, the patch-eyed Israeli general. So he was clearly a man of some stature in the Israeli military. He was a key leader in forming Peace Now in Israel. And it was formed because the Israelis were worried that with Begin, they weren't sure Begin would respond to Sadat at all. So they wanted a push on that. And they also wanted a push for negotiations with the Palestinians. So the Reagan Initiative begins to unfold, but, and this is one of the things that you have to understand, even though you can cry over it, it runs out of steam. In other words, if the initiative could have been announced and everybody said, oh, this is great, let's all do it together, this is sweet, you know, and the Palestinians would agree, and the Israelis, and Jordan would have been very, but it doesn't happen that way. You got to keep pushing, you got to keep this, and you got to keep working. And one of the things about this particular initiative that's fascinating is that Begin, which is the Likud, the conservative part of the Israeli political spectrum, was in power, which meant the Labor Party, which was the more liberal, if you will, and more peace-oriented part of the spectrum, was out of power. And among the key leaders in the Labor Party, out of power, were Abba Ibn, quite a famous Israeli foreign minister, and Shimon Peres, who already was interested in the possibility of peace with the Palestinians. They're out of office. So a journalist for the New York Times comes out to do a study or to do a couple of columns in the Times about what's going on and talks with Iban and with Peres and gets a message from them. And the message is the U.S. should use the influence of its economic aid to Israel to get Israel to stop building settlements. This now, remember, is 1982 or 83. He writes the column, doesn't mention the name of the, but says prominent Labor Party people. They individually deny that they said something to him. Though our friend David Shipler, who was then the Times correspondent in Jerusalem, that's who he met with. That's who said this. So it's interesting that you have these major Labor Party figures saying, use the pressure, by the way, economic aid, not military aid. They made a distinction. They said, look, if you start threatening military aid immediately, everybody gets scared. If you say, we're going to give you less economic aid, it's a different, it has a different vibe to it. So, and Reagan was aware of this. Reagan was aware of this. But Reagan and the Congress all get up in arms and say, we'll never cut aid to Israel. So, and this is important that you have Israelis advising this, to do this. And you have Americans for various political reasons at home saying, nope, we'll never do it. So eventually the Reagan Initiative fades in the sunset. And I can go into the details of that. It was sad for us because, I mean, we had never lived in the process of a peace agreement and going to see advisors to King Hussein, who was trying to make a deal. He was trying to get the PLO to be willing to come to negotiation with the king, that is, as part of one delegation. So the U.S. didn't have to exactly say that they were negotiating with the PLO. So they were trying to fudge that scene. And it didn't work, partly because the trade-off they hoped was that at least the U.S. would accept that the Palestinians had a right of national self-determination. Once you say that, sounds like state. So the U.S., Reagan said no to that. So the Reagan Initiative goes. The next thing that happens, bless the Lutherans. You know, I've given talks in the Northwest, and when I talk about Oslo, the Oslo process, oh, Lutherans just love it, you know. And I gave a talk in Pennsylvania, and I tried the same tactic, and people didn't even smile. And somebody leaned over to me and said, you know, they're German Lutherans. But Oslo, Norway, why Norway? Norway had helped to rescue Jews from the Nazis. Norway gave a proportion of development aid to developing countries and to the Palestinians that was so far in advance of any other countries or up in the top ranks. So Palestinians, both Palestinians and Israeli Jews, had an appreciation for Norway. So when Norway quietly says, why don't you come to Oslo to talk? Arafat agrees. Rabin, who's then the prime minister, agrees. And off go these delegations to the snows of Norway. And I'm sure that was a useful thing, too, because you know damn well they wanted to get out of there. And this is where there's this wonderful encounter after a rough day of negotiations between Abu Ala, who's the chief Palestinian negotiator, and Uri Sevier, the chief Israeli negotiator, and they're walking to dinner, and the one turns to the other and says, you know what really bugs me about you is you remind me of ourselves. And then the other one says, you know, that's the trouble I have with you. So each side coming in a process where as they meet each other, they're beginning to see mirror images of themselves in terms of the fears, the aspirations, the internal tensions among their people. So in any case, that process, 1993, produces a peace agreement. Where do they go to sign it? Remember?
Camp David.
Well, not Camp David, but to the White House lawn. The White House lawn. They come, and you say, well, why couldn't they just sign it in Oslo? Well, the reason was that while the Norwegian government could play this backdoor role in secret negotiations between the sides, when they want to announce the agreement, they want to announce it on the elephant's lawn. Because the elephant can protect the agreement and can help it go to success. In Norway, not likely. So there's this ceremony on the White House lawn, which I had the privilege, along with Jewish, Christian, Muslim leaders in this interreligious committee, of attending. And one of the moments that was most revealing was that I don't know if you remember the scene, it happened to be rather vividly stuck in my mind, where President Clinton, sort of nudges Rabin and Arafat toward each other, and they shake hands. Well, here's this audience of 2,000 people from the region and Americans, Jews and Arabs and very sophisticated. I mean, people have been dealing with this conflict, writing books about it for years. When those two men's hands grasped, there was an audible, almost as if liturgically written, scripted, 2,000, and I say that to just say something about here are these sophisticated know-it-all people who never thought they would see and couldn't imagine they were seeing what they were seeing. The handshake between Rabin, who, by the way, didn't have the reputation of being a gentle peacemaking guy. His reputation was as a tough soldier who was willing to break the bones of Palestinians who engaged in what was called an intifada or an uprising. And of course, on the other side, do I have to talk about Arafat's negative images? Probably not. He also, terrorist, certainly not someone who was a gentle peacemaking person. I mean, he wouldn't have, neither one would have gotten along well with some of the songs we sing here, you know. Maybe. I mean, let's not judge them too often. So they shake hands, and then of course they have to do the work of implementing the peace process, and it ain't easy. But one of the things that happens early on is for the first time in the history of the conflict, the leadership of the Palestinian National Movement gets back on Palestinian soil. You remember that they were in Jordan. PLO was in Jordan. PLO was in Lebanon. After they got pushed out of Lebanon, they went to Yemen. They went to Tunisia. And now they come back into Gaza and the West Bank. And Arafat's last years are spent in Ramallah. Well, don't underestimate the significance of that achievement, or from an Israeli point, the significance of agreeing to that happening. Because now the very leaders of the movement that claim the same land are on the land. They're no longer in exile. They're no longer outside the land. So the process goes on with all kinds of tumbles and turns and difficulties. And then the major event in that piece of the peace movement, and I think for the whole series of trying to make peace, happens, which is Rabin is assassinated. Rabin is assassinated. The Prime Minister of Israel is assassinated. And I remember getting a call from a Palestinian Muslim colleague in this movement that I was working with, or committee I was working with, named Dawood Assad, who said, Ron, he said, I'm so relieved. I said, and it was the day that Rabin was killed. And I said, relieved, Dawood? He said, yes, relieved. I thought it was a Palestinian who had killed Rabin. But it was a Jew. It was an extremist Israeli Jew, with the support ideologically of a collection of rabbis, extreme Orthodox rabbis, who thought the process of making peace was absolutely against Torah, against Jewish teachings. Now, obviously, there were other rabbis and other Jews and other Israelis who were very pleased, even somewhat excited and hopeful about the process. But Rabin is assassinated, and very interestingly, and this didn't come out right at the time, but I think it's true. At the time, Rabin was arguing for speeding up the negotiating process toward a conclusion because he feared that the longer the negotiation was stretched out, the more time extremists would have to torpedo the process. And of course, they did in a major, major way by killing him. So Shimon Peres takes over. This is November 95. Shimon Peres takes over, and elections are scheduled for 96. In the lead up to the elections, which most Israelis assumed that Peres would win, partly by they were involved in this process and Peres was the natural inheritor of it. In the lead up to the process, Palestinians in a new movement that has been created called Hamas launch several suicide attacks on Israelis, mainly civilians, and kill some 300 people in the several months leading up to the elections. And literally, I think no one would argue with this, as a result, Bibi Netanyahu wins the election, and Peres is out. So, as I said at the beginning, there's enough blame to go around, you know. And Netanyahu, certainly his attitude toward the whole process was very different than Rabin's. So we're talking the peace process, still the Oslo process. Clinton's still in office till 2001. And in 2000, right at the end of his term, his second term, Clinton decides to call a meeting, a summit meeting at Camp David to try to wrap up the Oslo process, which certainly is not a bad idea. Politically, you understand a president that devoted a fair amount of energy to the process would like to sort of cap the thing with his having chaired the meeting that made the peace agreement. The problem, of course, is not all things can be rushed. And tough things that you try to rush better be very well prepared. And there's ample evidence that our Clinton administration did not do a very good job of preparing the groundwork. Let me give you just one example. Everybody understood that Jerusalem was going to have to be shared. That Palestinians, as strongly as Israeli Jews, believed it was their capital. Muslims believed it was their holy city, just as strongly as Christians or Jews did. So everybody who was knowledgeable of the things knew there was going to have to be, it's going to have to be a shared city. The Palestinian capital is going to have to be probably in one part, the eastern part, and the Israeli capital in the western part. This all seemed clear to people. The other thing that seemed clear, if Arafat was going to accept that as a compromise, he would need support from Saudi Arabia. Why? Because Saudi Arabia was the keeper of the Holy Grail on Islam, on Muslim stuff. Saudi Arabia apparently was approachable on that, but never approached before the summit. Never approached. And so Arafat, sitting in that summit meeting, figuring if he's going to sign something, didn't have any message from the King of Saudi Arabia that we understand the compromise necessary. So ill-prepared, and I can go down other issues, including refugees, that were ill-prepared. They were very, those two issues, refugees in Jerusalem, as you can imagine, were very emotional. So if you're going to prepare carefully on anything, you better prepare on issues that can explode very quickly. And apparently the U.S. didn't do it, partly because Clinton was rushing, you know, he's going out of office. He wanted to get it done and blah, blah, you have some. Well, it didn't work. And of course, when it doesn't work, there's a reaction to it, a kind of frustration. And of course, the frustration all gets directed at the other side. It's they who failed to, they because of their positions, it didn't work. And you had the outbreak of a second Palestinian uprising, or Intifada, as it's called, Palestinian Intifada. And this one, the first one, more or less stuck to nonviolence, not in a pacifistic way, but sort of in a strategic way. This one is rougher. It includes violence, partly because of Hamas, but also partly because of not Hamas Palestinians frustrated by Israel's holding on, Israel's settlements, et cetera, et cetera. So you have outbreak of violence, and for Israelis, their view, many Israelis' view was, we were so close to an agreement, and they wouldn't accept it, and now they're going to attack us again. And so it's all off, and the distrust is multiplied, and the hatred is multiplied. Bless him, President Bush, George W. Bush, who came into office then, this is still now early 2001, appoints two people to head commissions to see how they can how the process can get beyond the violence, get back to the negotiations. Senator Mitchell, one commission, and George Tenet, head of CIA, another commission. And they do very important, significant work, come back with reports, recommendations, what needs to happen to get things back on track. Nothing is done to follow up those commissions. Nothing. And I can't speak about George Tenet in the same way, but I already have given my own view away about Senator Mitchell. I think he's really one of the heroes of peacemaking, not just in Northern Ireland. And I don't know if you happen to know, but he's Lebanese. So he understands stuff about the Middle East that is pretty helpful. So the commission's recommendations are not followed up on. And then, of course, where are we? Beginning of 2001. You know what happened in September 2001, right? Right, 9/11. And you know, even though George W. Bush said he wasn't going to do anything like Clinton was doing on Israeli-Palestinian, eventually he comes around and does something called the Roadmap to Peace. But really his preoccupation, once 9/11 occurs, is with Iraq and Afghanistan. So in a certain sense, it's like Carter. I mean, I'm not saying George W. Bush is like Carter. I'm saying that their situations, all of a sudden they're confronted with something, the Iranian Revolution and a hostage crisis, 9/11 attacks on the United States and Iraq and dealing with Afghanistan and Iraq, and they're totally focused on that. So roadmap to peace. I mean, it's launched, and it's launched, by the way, in cooperation with Russia and the European Union and the Secretary General of the UN. And by the, interestingly, Israelis and Palestinians say there's a lot that's positive about this if it's carried through, but it's not carried through very much, including, by the way, provisions in the roadmap to peace that said there are certain things that each party has to do, and there were a good list of things, including stopping settlements, including stopping violent attacks against Israelis, certain things that each side had to do, and there would be a monitoring system, and the sides would be held accountable. Monitoring system and held accountable? Hardly at all. So you eventually have the roadmap to peace just going down the tube. I mean, people, you know, you can sort of have a roadmap to peace so long, but if it doesn't get you closer to something, what kind of roadmap is it? All right, so there we are with George W. Bush. Then we have a development that's interesting, partly because it sounds like it couldn't be true. President Sharon, now president of Israel, comes to the same view that Israel Peace Now had for years, which is we can't hold on to these territories and continue to be a majority Jewish state. Because if you hold on to Gaza and the West Bank, a majority of the people in the total area of Israel are going to be Palestinian, and eventually they're going to have rights, so there won't be a Jewish majority. So Sharon comes to this conclusion, and by the way, speaks about it. He doesn't say, I came to the same conclusion that Peace Now does. He makes it sound as if he discovered it himself. But he withdraws Israel from Gaza, tears down the settlements and pulls out of Gaza. What he doesn't do, of course, is free Gaza, because Gaza is still surrounded by the Israeli military. But he does pull out. He doesn't negotiate that with the Palestinians, so there's no way sort of to say, well, you're supposed to do certain things in exchange. But Sharon pulls out, 2005. Bush, George W. Bush, of course, is still in power. He calls a conference in Annapolis in 2007. And again, you know, it's amazing. I mean, partly because people are so desperate and also realistic that the only way to resolve this is to get the two sides to agree on something, to agree on a peace agreement. Every time there's a new initiative, even if people have been through several and they found them and they fail, they say, well, you know, let's try to help it work. Maybe this time it'll be work. And the Annapolis conference had that sort of air about it. And then, as a result of the Annapolis conference, President Abbas of the Palestinian side and President Olmert of the Israeli side begin a series of 64 secret meetings and arrive at a point where Olmert comes to Abbas with a map of borders, which includes trade-offs where some settlements, Israeli settlements, close to the 1967 line would become part of Israel, and Israel would give equal amounts or almost equal amounts of territory to the Palestinian state. He comes with a map, shows it to Abbas. Abbas says, let me take it back to my people. And Omar says, no, I can't give it to you. Well, of course, that's a delicate moment. And again, not simple, but simplified, the version is that Abbas can't possibly sign something that he hasn't taken back and showed to others. And Olmert doesn't trust Abbas to just take it back and show it to others. He fears he'd take it back and publicize it. And then Olmert is caught having given certain compromises that if the other side isn't going to accept, then he looks like a fool. Plus the fact that Olmert is now under the shadow of a scandal about finances, which eventually puts him in prison, if you remember. I mean, he resigns first, but goes to prison. And Abbas knows this, and Abbas is thinking, God, you know, I'm going to sign this with Olmert. He's going to go to jail. And then who's coming next, and what are they going to say? So there's this nervousness that doesn't really have to do with substance as much as it does with reliability of leadership on the other side. So those, and those are interesting. There are articles about this. You can read them. And it's one of the examples where the parties or the government's leaders of the parties came very close to what probably is the only kind of agreement that eventually would work. Okay, Barack Obama, we're up to him, comes in and makes this grand gesture of the trip to Cairo and the address to the Muslim world, which was very inspired and inspiring. A little bit of a wrinkle was that you could imagine a U.S. president going first to Israel. Or at least you could imagine a U.S. president, if he's going to Cairo, going also to Israel. Obama decides, for whatever combination of reasons, that he'd just go to Egypt. Well, that makes the Israelis a little nervous, and the American Jewish community, including the liberal parts of it, a little nervous. What's going on here? Even though when he speaks in Cairo, he speaks about the rights of the Jewish people and Israel to exist and all that. But, you know, symbols are important. Now, my own take on that is what was stupid, however it was decided not to make the trip to both at the same time, it was a damn stupid thing not to go to Israel soon after that. And in fact, Obama, several years later, goes to Jerusalem and makes this speech to young Israelis that's quite moving, about both their fears and sense of commitment to Israel, but also about understanding the Palestinians and their commitments and their needs. And it's a very moving speech, but better maybe to have been made shortly after his trip to Cairo than several years later. But, you know, these are obviously, don't we all, if you're a pastor or if you're a teacher, remember things, yeah, I wish I had done that a little differently. And the pressures are enormous. So I don't mean to sound judgmental. I mean to sound some perspective on this. And then Obama goes out on a note. Some people may consider it a high note, which is he, for the first time, the U.S. does not veto a U.N. Security Council resolution condemning settlements. You remember this? December 2016. Got a lot of play in the press that this was a new thing. Jewish community reaction was negative. And interestingly, I now have come to the insight that what did it really mean to do that in December 2016 when you were leaving office? It didn't mean squat. All it meant was it just was an annoyance. That is to say, it didn't set any precedent. It didn't accomplish anything. If it had been done 5 years earlier, when you were in power and had to deal with the shakeup or with the vibrations after, another question, another issue. But to do it in December 2016, what does it get you? What is it? Where does it? How does it move things? I mean, it allowed Trump one more easy shot at Hillary. You know, even Hillary, I think, sort of stood a little bit distant from it, from that vote. Even though the vote, one could say, is principled and right. Not vote, the abstention. I mean, the U.S. abstained, and that's why the thing could go forward. So here we are, all these initiatives. And please remember, because if you don't remember and you say anything about this to others, somebody will remember that there were other factors, other pressures. I mean, that other places to put some blame, including on the Israeli government, including on the Palestinian leadership. I mean, just take the split between Hamas and Fatah. So, you know, which is the Palestinian government? And if you negotiate a deal with Fatah, do you have a deal with Hamas? And then when Hamas and Fatah talk about getting back together, it scares the hell out of Israelis because it's the anti-Israeli group with the group that says it's ready to negotiate with Israel getting together. Where does that come out? I mean, so there's enough blame to go around. The Arab states also tremendously cautious about giving any signals. There's an Arab peace initiative, but as carefully worded as you could do it. So it doesn't sort of strike the hearts of Israelis. Many smart Israelis smart in the sense of following things strategically and politically, thought the Arab peace initiative was a positive thing, but there was a kind of tone of it, an aspect of it that certainly wasn't the kind of thing that Sadat did. You know, Sadat really touched Israeli and Jewish hearts by his saying, I want to come to Jerusalem to negotiate peace. So here we are. I'd like to take a break for a few minutes and then wrap it up and you know, see how we'd make Israeli-Palestinian peace. I mean, I know several of you came with that expectation. So if anyone needs to go to the bathroom or something, let's do it. We'll try to start in, say, 5 minutes. And if nobody has to go, maybe we can actually get the peace. Get the peace, I said, not the peace. Peace.
Didn't Ariel Sharon say, if we cut them up into little pieces, they'll never be able to reorganize?
I'll bet he did. I mean, you know, and if it wasn't him, it might have been Rabin. That is to say, both were hawks of different types. But, you know, it was Sharon who decided that we've got to get out. And he not only said, we're going to get out of Gaza, but he said, we've got to get out of the West Bank, too. He said it before he had a stroke. Maybe that's why he had a stroke. Because it was such a contradiction with his personality and his history. Yeah, no, I mean, when I'm talking about it's 2005. I mean, certainly Carter's ego was involved in helping to make peace with Egypt and Israel, but he put it to... good use. And then, you know, the whole business of the capacity of a political figure to change the main emphasis of what he's doing. So you take Rabin, who was a warrior, and was ready to be a warrior again, deciding that this peace thing is possible and necessary and we can do it. And then beginning to think that it's got to be, we got to go faster. You know? That was a guess. Well, and you know, of course it took a lot. Well, and it, you know, how many wars did it take before Rabin got to where he was ready to say that? You know? I mean, Sadat had lost at least three wars, the War of 48, the War of 48, the War sort of 57 or 56, the War of 67, the War of 73. So it took four wars to get him to change his mind. That's not a very, not a sort of exemplary changing of minds. It took the Israelis, I mean, in 1976, the Israeli government allowed elections in the West Bank and Gaza for mayors. the mayors, to a person, who were elected, were loyal to the PLO, even though the Israelis thought that because of their control in the area, the people who would be arrested, or would be elected, would be easier to deal with. Turned out, to a person, they were loyal to the PLO, but they were also not the PLO, and could have served as bridges to negotiations. But Israel wasn't ready until about 8-10 years later to negotiate with the PLO. So what they did, as these mayors began to speak out more and more, they got rid of them. There were assassination attempts, not by necessarily the Israeli government, by extremists, but then also the government, the Israeli military, threw them across the border into Lebanon. Lebanon or to Jordan. And then, interestingly enough, one of the mayors, the mayor of Hebron, which is the largest city in the West Bank, whom Carol and I got to know quite well, Mayor Kawasme, who advocated nonviolent resistance to the occupation, was quite strong on that. He's assassinated by a Palestinian extremist because he's talking with Israel or willing to talk with Israel. Well, that's, anybody who says that, I like very much, because, I, as I say, the people that scare me are the people who don't think it's complicated. Well, let's start up again, and people will drift back in, I assume. Yeah, don't forget these papers, including the one where I say Putin and Trump, maybe they can do something good.
You heard it here first.
What? You heard it here first, right. You can say, high up in a mountain where there was no news and too much booze, I heard that Putin and Trump.
A silver-haired guru.
A drunken guru.
Where's the booze?
Oh, I'm not telling. There's a brewery right here in camp, I hear. It's not all in one place. Well, maybe that's another tour that they should organize after the nature tour, right? The natural spirits tour. So Trump says on February 15th, when he's meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu, I'm open to one state or two states, whatever the parties would agree to, I would accept. Well, it sounds, you know, who could disagree with that? And in a certain principled way, I would say, that's right, you know, whatever the parties can agree to. For many years, as I said before, each side really wanted the other side to disappear. So the fact that there is a willingness, even if not every day, but a willingness to say we've got to negotiate with the other side to come to some conclusion of this is a positive thing. The problem is that I think that neither side's version of a one-state solution has much of a chance of occurring. Why? Well, the Israeli version of one state is Israel will keep control of the West Bank and to an extent keep Gaza surrounded, and that in those areas, Palestinians will not be allowed to vote. Only Jews will be allowed to vote. Well, we've heard of that system before. That is apartheid. And we know historically that apartheid systems are not likely to last. And we know from Palestinians who have been resisting over the years, despite the high price they have paid, that Palestinians, like black South Africans, are not going to go away. They're not going to give in. So that's the Israeli version of one state, not likely to happen. What's the Palestinian version? The Palestinian version is that between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, that is Israel as it's now defined, plus the West Bank and Gaza, everyone will be equal and all will have the right to vote. What's the problem with that? The problem with that is demographically, that means a majority of Palestinians. That means the end of a Jewish majority state, which was a foundational reason for creating Israel in the first place. That is, to have a place. Jews believed they needed a place in the world where they were the majority, because their experiences in places where they were the minority had not been terrific. And you know, we have to remember our own country in that respect. Jews were not admitted to the school I went to in the 1950s, Wesleyan University. And when they began to be admitted, there were small quotas that once they were filled, that was enough Jews. We had enough Jews. So the idea that the vast majority of Jews, I'm not saying there are no Jews who would accept that idea. There are Jews, and there have been Jews advocating that for some time. But in terms of any sort of large number, majority of Jews, either in Israel or among American Jews, who would accept the idea that Israel would disappear as a majority Jewish state, it's not there. It's not there to happen. So the reason you come back to two states, even when it hasn't been achieved, even when the chances of it being achieved seem smaller because of the settlements, you come back to it because you don't think either of the other ideas have as much of a chance to work. Yeah?
What's that population differential roughly?
Between Jews and Palestinians in that whole area?
Yeah. I mean, when you say if they went one state, it'd be imbalanced.
Well, it's... I can't give you the precise figure. You can look that up. But it's no one disagrees with the proposition that if you add up all the people in that area, including West Bank, Gaza, and Israel, quote, proper Israel now, or Israel as it's defined now, you wind up, even now, with a majority of Palestinians. And a birth rate among Palestinians that's higher than Jews, except for Orthodox Jews, which tend to have a competitive birth rate among them. So, you know, that's, and it's interesting. I mean, if you think you're frustrated with the lack of a solution, just think what it must be like to be an Israeli or a Palestinian, you know. Because their frustration is in blood. I mean, it's their kids, it's their, you know, it's their relatives, it's their friends that are killed by one war and one incident after another. It's interesting that despite the frustration and the deep, really deep distrust of both sides for the other, partly because they believed that it was the other side that was responsible for not making that initiative work, recent polls done by very credible Israeli-Palestinian research organizations of Israeli and Palestinian opinion shows that somewhere in the 51 to 53% range, Israelis and Palestinians still support the idea of two states. And by two states, they mean a Palestinian state largely in the West Bank and Gaza, and an Israeli state not in the West Bank and Gaza, that is, in where Israel is with its borders. Additional things about that poll that are interesting is, number one, if the peace agreement includes a dimension of peace with Arab countries, the majorities on both sides go up. Which means on the Palestinian side, they have a sort of, their backs are covered for making any compromises if Saudi Arabia, you know, Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Egypt, et cetera, Syria now a different picture because of the war there. But if Arab states join in the peace agreement, Palestinians feel sort of reassured because their backs are covered. And Israelis feel more reassured because with the peace with the Palestinians, they're actually getting peace with these other Arab states, which now they have peace with Egypt and Israel, and you can bet there's no Israeli that's trying to get rid of peace with Egypt or Jordan. They want that. It may not be a warm peace. They may be nervous about the government in either place or what's happening in either place, but they don't want to lose it because it's a non-war situation, which is better than a war situation. The other thing that has been said or comes out in the polls is if there are some incentives, which can be money, of course, but if there are some incentives attached to the two-state agreement, that majorities of support on both sides likely go up. You can then talk about what the incentives are. What I want to do is just say now, I mean, since you expected to come and find peace here, I'm teasing, but not entirely, because you know, you get around and find, well, is it possible or not? Here's an outline of the peace agreement. And one of the things that's important to note is that to the credit of Israeli and Palestinian peacemakers, and I think one of the last pieces in your packet today is a piece I've written for the Everett Herald that honors, or I guess, what does it say? I think it says honoring Israeli-Palestinian peacemakers, who were peacemakers back as far as the 60s, at least, on both sides. Some of them paid with their lives. Obviously, Rabin is one. But Fahd Kawasmi, the mayor of Hebron, was killed by a Palestinian extremist. Not a Jewish extremist, a Palestinian extremist. Peacemakers, including ones who were part of official negotiations at Camp David, at Taba, ones negotiations that didn't succeed, they did make progress. They came up with ideas for the compromises. And this is a sort of brief summary of what those ideas are. On borders, if you look at a map of Israel, you know there's something that was called the Green Line, which was the 67 border, and you can see the West Bank there. And now if you look at it, you'll see that there are many Israeli settlements across the line in the West Bank. 70% of the settlers who live in the West Bank, Jewish settlers, live in areas very close to the Green Line. Others live deep in the West Bank. The ones who live deep in the West Bank, settlements will have to go. There's no two ways about that. Palestinians will not accept settlements way into the West Bank. But the ones that are along the border, there's now an agreement, or has been agreement in many, many discussions, that those settlements will be incorporated into Israel and that Israel will give land next to Gaza or next to the northern part of the West Bank in somewhat equal, there's argument about whether it's absolutely equal, one-to-one or whatever, to the Palestinian state, so they'll wind up with the same amount of territory they would have if they got the whole West Bank and Gaza. So that's number one on the sort of border thing. And by the way, the Arab states have now given a green light to the idea of that land swap. That's important because heretofore, the Arab states have been said, has to be strictly on the basis of 242. So you've got to get out of all the occupied territory. That's a must. Now they're saying, we accept the idea of land swaps. So that's borders. Security. Palestinian Authority would be responsible for security in their areas. Israel would be responsible for security in their areas. I mean, it's a simple kind of thing. And there would be some sort of cooperation between. And most likely the Palestinian state would be demilitarized. Now you say, I mean, there are some Palestinians and others who say that's not fair, every state has an army. At least some Palestinians said, what are we going to do with an army? Israel has the fifth most powerful military in the world. Is our having an army going to really make us safer? Or actually maybe more vulnerable? So there are Palestinians who say, we've got to have police, we've got to have certain equipment, we've got to have, you know, da-da-da-da-da. But the idea of our having an army, maybe it's not all that it's cooked up to be in terms of what really protects us. So, security. Palestinian responsible for authority, security in their areas, Israeli responsible for their refugees. This is a huge issue because you can still go out today and meet Palestinians who hold the key to properties inside Israel. And they say, these are my grandparents' property. And I'll never give them up. Except oftentimes in other contexts, they will say, I know we're never going back there. Depending on the context. I mean, I've taken groups out where we've met with Palestinian women who say the absolute thing about the key. And then when you get to talk about a negotiated agreement, somehow the key has some less importance to the idea that there will not be another war with Israel.
What about giving them money?
Well, I didn't finish that. I'm not saying a refugee issue. I'm just saying that the idea of the Palestinian refugees all going back into Israel is problematic. It's not, Israel won't accept it. In fact, polls done among Palestinians in Lebanon, refugees in Lebanon, say that something like 90% of them are not interested in going back. Well, they've been out for, what, how many years? Since 48? So, you know, they've established either lives there or between there and Canada. Now, the other piece of it, you're absolutely right. Well, first to say, where would refugees go back to? Palestinians, in any agreement that is going to be reached, Palestinians would have a right of return to their state, whatever the Palestinian state is. They would have a right of return. Now, would they want to go back there? Depends on economics, depends on da-da-da-da. But they would have a right of return to the Palestinian state. Second, in terms of compensation, Palestinians would have a right who are not going to go back, go to a Palestinian state. Or, by the way, there have been discussions of some 50,000 to 100,000 Palestinians actually going back to live inside Israel on a family reunification basis. In other words, if they have family who still live in Israel and now are Israeli citizens, some number, there could be agreement on some number. And the numbers that have been talked about by the governments are somewhere 50,000 to 100,000. It's a small number compared to the number of refugees. Refugees who do not do that or go to a Palestinian state would have a right of compensation and resettlement. Either resettlement where they are, they may be living in Lebanon, and they would then, a question of normalization as Lebanese citizens, with compensation, with money, some of that money going to the Lebanese government for accepting that they're going to have this many more Lebanese citizens. I mean, so the payment is not just to the refugees, it's also to help ease the path for citizenship, or to third countries. And by the way, in the negotiations about refugees that took place in the Madrid Peace Conference, Canada already offered to take, I forget the number, 200,000, 300,000 Palestinian refugees. So third countries, that would be third country settlement with compensation. That's the kind of idea that has been not just bantered about, but negotiated by official delegations and also in a lot of unofficial meetings. Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the capital of Palestine and of Israel. And you can say it's only the capital of Israel, but then you haven't talked to Palestinians. You haven't listened to Palestinians. You know, I mean, that makes it easy, of course. And if you talk to some Palestinians, they may not have any idea of or any recognition of Jewish connection historically to Jerusalem. Well, that may be what they have or what they understand, but, you know, there are a lot of Jews. Or every Jew who has some sense of connection to Jerusalem. I remember a conversation with a rabbi who had moved from Canada and become Israeli citizen. And he said, Ron, you meet with the Palestinians, don't you? And I said, yes. He said, you got to get them to understand that when we Jews come here to this land, we've come home. And I said to him, David, all the Palestinians want you to understand is that when you come here, they were home. And there's the rub, you know. I have no doubt, after having lived with and listened to Israelis and Palestinians, that both believe those things absolutely. Both believe those things absolutely, and there's historic evidence as to why they do. And historic motivation for why Jews, after centuries, you say, well, that goes way back, you know. The trouble is that between way back and now, there was a Holocaust and persecution of Jews in other places. Not largely in Arab Muslim places, ironically. Not largely in Arab Muslim places. In Arab Muslim places, there was a dhimmi system. There was a, you know, limitation on how far Jewish could rise in what areas of society. But there certainly wasn't Nazism. In fact, there was a recognition that people had rights, Jews had rights. So, Jerusalem, capital of both Palestine and Israel, and one of the ironies, a man I mentioned Monday, Dan Kurtzer, who was then ambassador to Israel, apparently floated an idea in the State Department during these negotiations under Clinton that the U.S. should recognize the basis for two capitals in Jerusalem, should announce that. Well, that would have thrown a monkey wrench into some thinking, but what a great idea. Because it would have put the U.S. on record recognizing that Jerusalem does not belong just to Israel. But the idea was never followed up on. It was a memo that was circulated in the State Department, but that's as far as it got. That's as far as it got. I assume it may have been seen by Clinton. So Jerusalem, two capitals. Obviously, you've got to work out the religious stuff around the wall and the Temple Mount. And surely both sides are smart enough to recognize that that's not going to be all worked out by politics. It's got to be worked out by religious authorities, recognizing certain no-go areas or careful go, don't tread too heavily here, and respecting each other's religious connections to the wall and to the Temple Mount, to the surface of the Temple Mount. And then, upside down. Well, those are the four basic issues, and the other is just the simple phrase "end of conflict," which means that, once these issues are negotiated and resolved, there's agreement by both sides that the conflict is over. And that's important because there's suspicion on both sides that you didn't really mean it. You didn't really mean it. So even though you may accept the compromise, you're really going for something else. And to the extent that there's a formal agreement that the conflict is over, it's an important piece of it. Obviously, it doesn't assure that everybody's going to think it's over, but it's an important one. Well, I encourage you to read the last piece in the packet where I do talk about some of the early Israeli-Palestinian peacemakers, some of whom Carol and I knew quite well and personally, and some of them are still alive, some of them have passed away naturally, and others passed away not so naturally. But that's where we are. I think the thing that could happen, the best thing that could happen soon, is that, number one, this man, Jason Greenblatt, who's in the Trump administration and was sent out there, he's an Orthodox Jew, was sent out there a few weeks after Trump came into office and met with Israelis and Palestinians, and to a person, Israelis and Palestinians said he really is a very good listener. He really listened to what we were saying. And I thought to myself, well, there's a not-Trump phenomena, right? No, I mean, you don't associate listening with Trump. But somehow this guy, Jason Greenblatt, was appointed, and he's, I think he's a friend of Jared's, and he's an Orthodox Jew, and he, for whatever combination of biography, etc., he is a good listener. And that listening obviously came back to Jared and came back to President Trump. So that's interesting. The religious leaders I'm working with as a consultant, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, heads of their organizations, including Bishop Eaton, we are in the process now of seeking a meeting with Jason Greenblatt to see, to explore and to talk with him about ideas and what ways we might be helpful. The other thing is, I think it's too bad the Obama administration didn't do this. Everybody who you talk to who's knowledgeable about a possible resolution of the conflict knows that the outline I gave you is something like what's going to be possible. Possible in the sense that you could possibly get both sides to agree to it. I mean, that's what possible means, not some abstract thing. And I think it's a shame that the Obama administration didn't go to the UN Security Council seeking endorsement of this sort of an outline of the principles. Because then the Security Council would be on record as supporting that. And in a way, it doesn't tie the hands of the parties, but it at least provides some leverage with the parties to say, if you're going to negotiate, you got to negotiate about this sort of set of principles, based on this set of principles. Now, whether Trump would do that with his anti-UN stuff, I sort of doubt. But that would be helpful now if the UN Security Council were to adopt a resolution that said these are the principles that need to be the basis of a two-state peace agreement. The Security Council is on record for two states, so we'll see. I guess the reason I'm hopeful is because people out there need it. You know, I mean, they need it in the sense that nobody wants to imagine that their children or grandchildren are going to be in another war. So they need it. And number two, there's been enough done to get there that if you're paying attention a little bit, yep, that's basically, yep. You sort of check off those are the things that are likely to be the compromises that'll get us there. And that's sort of a kind of realism thing. And I take peace on the basis of realism any day on the basis, rather than peace on the basis of somebody's vision, you know. Because realism is, I mean, it's sort of reality-based. It's like Obama said about Trump. Well, when he gets to be president, he'll begin to realize that reality puts a certain pressure on him.
Well, could use a little more of it.
What about the superheated fear on Netanyahu's part of Iran that we hear about so loudly?
Well, I'm glad you asked it. Very brief answer is that crucial to allowing Obama to go ahead with that agreement and not have it voted down in the Congress. You remember there was an expectation it might be voted down and then he would have to veto the whatever the Congress did. The reason that didn't happen, the most important reason, is that 90 former military and national security advisors from Israel lobbied for the agreement, for the Iran agreement, because they saw that this was an important 10-year postponement of a threat of nuclear weapons being in Iran. So that's interesting, and Netanyahu knows that. Netanyahu, the other thing about him is that, you know, he heads a coalition that's very narrow. And I said to someone yesterday, if there are some sort of pressures from the Palestinians, from the U.S., from Trump, from Israeli citizens, enough pressure, where he begins to see his power being threatened, what he will do is disband his coalition and form a new one that'll have more elements of the center and left in it. So his power is secure. That's what he'll do. And securing his power is his number one goal. So, yeah.
I can see where land swaps might make a two-state solution
workable.
Workable. But control of water is very important there, I know. And the Israelis are controlling that water very severely.
Yep.
Is there any talk about that in this world?
Well, of course, the one question is where are the sources of water? And if the sources of water are partly in a Palestinian state, when there's a Palestinian state formed, the control goes to the Palestinians. There's no doubt about that. But the other answer to that question is when the Madrid Peace Conference happened, there was a second ring of negotiations that went on about issues that weren't exactly the political nub of the issue between Israel and the Arab states. And one of them was water issues. And what was concluded out of those talks was that water issues have to be resolved in the whole region, not just between Israel and Palestine. That is, you have to take account of Jordan, of Syria, the Tigris River. You have to take account of ocean water. In other words, you have to look at the bigger picture, because even if you get the water controlled in a fairer way, there are still severe limitations to the amount of water, and therefore you've got to bring in other elements to help them, to resolve it. And there, by the way, there, that's you can Google that. You can talk water resources and what's to be done. Yes?
Most of the water comes out of the Golan Heights as far as fresh water into Israel and Palestine.
Okay.
So it comes down into the Sea of Galilee, and so the ongoing conflict with Syria over control of the Golan Heights has been a big deal.
Of course, of course. Well, and you know, I mean, in 95, when Rabin was still alive, there were negotiations between Syria and the U.S. and Israel that came pretty close to defining the principles that could end the Syrian-Israeli war, which at some point has to be ended. And the question is, what happens about the Golan Heights then? I mean, Syria's always maintained that the Golan Heights revert back. But, you know, I would be remiss if I tried to say more about the water issue than I just did. And I think I'm on solid ground that any sources of water that after a two-state agreement is reached are through the Palestinian territory, the Palestinian government exercises more control over than they do now. And number two, that there has to be this wider ring of discussion among parties, including going all the way up to Turkey. I mean, that Turkey's got to be involved too. Anybody else? What? I didn't. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
We have only talked about the wall.
About the wall.
Yes. What is the future of the wall?
Well, a couple of comments. One understands the rationale for the wall. That is to say, terrorists came from somewhere beyond the wall. If you put a wall up, you won't have terrorists. I mean, you won't get as many terrorists. There's some evidence for that being accurate. I mean, true that happened. Second, where the wall was built was not along the Green Line. It was built to make it safer for the Israeli settlements that were in territories that were in Israel. And by the way, the UN Security Council declared that the wall is illegal for precisely that reason. If the Israelis had built the wall along the 1967 line, UN Security Council really couldn't have said a thing about it, because it would have been built in Israeli territory. The fact that it's built to some extent, some of it is built in the occupied territories, it's internationally against international law. If there's this land swaps thing, it means that some of the settlements that are now, quote, on the Israeli side of the wall would be incorporated. Whether the wall would then come down, I don't know any negotiations that have gotten that far. It's a, you know, it's an ugly, awful thing. I mean, the reason I said first what I said is because I do understand that if Israelis are attacked by and feel threatened by terrorism coming from somewhere, I understand the instincts to put up a wall to try to stop it. Whether that stops it is not clear to me. It certainly isn't the solution. I mean, I'm all with the ELCA, which has this slogan, build peace, not walls, you know. I think that's the way to go. And I think, you know, there are a fair number of Israelis, not enough, but a fair number of Israelis who understand that too. Well, we've exhausted the topic, if not the participants, or if not the topic, the participants. Thank you. Thank you for coming in. Friday, we'll deal with Islam and Muslims.